So I did the protocol. It was 3 months, June, July, and August. And I found out in September that we were pregnant, which is crazy because we were actually supposed to start fertility treatments in October if we had not gotten pregnant yet. So I had made a deal with my doctor. I said, give me 3 months of trying this out before we start doing anything else. I don't want to go to a fertility specialist yet. I just want to see if we can do this naturally before I have to start doing IUI or IVF. Yeah, so we found out in September we were expecting, which is crazy, after nearly a year of trying to conceive.
Hello and welcome to PCOS Explained, formerly the PCOS Nutritionist Podcast. I'm your host, Claire Goodwin, a registered nutritionist and exercise scientist specializing in PCOS because I have it too. Each week, we'll uncover the latest research, share inspiring stories, and provide practical tips to help you thrive with PCOS. Whether you're newly diagnosed, you've been struggling with this for a long time, or supporting someone with PCOS, this podcast is your go-to resource for empowerment, education, and community. So join us as we uncover the tools to thrive with PCOS. PCOS Explained is brought to you by our very own service, Ovi. Ovi is your go-to health service for women with PCOS. We help you improve your PCOS symptoms and prevent the long-term complications of PCOS by giving you hyper-personalized health advice based on your specific symptoms and PCOS drivers. We have a range of plans to suit your needs, from a DIY app-based program to one-on-one consultations. You choose what suits your budget and learning preference. And we offer a result-based guarantee on our Premium Plus plan, meaning that if we don't help you achieve your goal, we refund your money. Ovi is available worldwide, so it doesn't matter whether you're based in the UK, US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, or anywhere else, we can still help you. This is a story from one of our past patients, Cindy. Cindy was diagnosed with PCOS in her late 20s after experiencing trouble conceiving for over 6 months. She knew something wasn't right. She speaks about the both positive and negative experiences with medical professionals and how the protocol, which is now known as OVE, educated her to truly understand her PCOS and why she was experiencing these symptoms. Fast forward 3 months, just a month before she was supposed to start fertility treatments, and Cindy fell pregnant naturally. After over 10 years of trying to figure out what was going on with her body and how to control her weight gain and stress levels, everything unraveled within the span of a few months. This gave Cindy the mental freedom to focus on the things that would actually make a difference and the things that mattered. So if any of these symptoms or experiences sounds like you, then listen in because Cindy has some true gems to share.
So welcome, Cindy. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. It's an absolute honor to have you on here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Amazing. So can you please start by telling us a bit about your PCOS story?
Yeah, so it's interesting because it started very recently, but it's not been that long for me. So I found out I had PCOS year, and I was 27 years old. My husband and I had been trying to conceive for about 6 months or so. And I was going to an OBGYN that I had been going to forever that my family went to. And I expressed some concerns with her about the fact that we hadn't conceived yet. And she's like, oh, don't worry about it. Just keep trying for a year and then we'll revisit it. And I was not comfortable with that. I'm a doer, not a waiter. So I asked around to from some other friends for recommendations of OBGYNs. I found a great one that I went to. And in the first appointment, I expressed my concerns. And she said, you know what? I agree. Let's do some testing. Find out what's going on with you right off the bat in our first visit. And I got scheduled for a sonogram and blood work right off the bat within a matter of weeks. And I got my results back and she's, you know what? She's, you have polycystic ovarian syndrome. And I was diagnosed at 27 years old, which is crazy to me because I feel like women find out much younger than that. And that was, May of 20, which is crazy. We're already at a year now.
but looking back, you were like, I haven't just developed these symptoms, right? Symptoms now finally make sense because I have this, someone's actually put the picture together for me.
Yes, absolutely. I had met one person before who had PCOS, and I vaguely knew some of the details of it, but not in depth, obviously. So then I started talking to my OBGYN about symptoms and looking things up on Google, right? And I was like, oh, first of all, I have extra hair on my upper lip, underneath my chin, not like a full beard, but I definitely had extra hair. And I was like, I've always had that. And I just assumed it was because I was Greek, right? Mm. And then I also had experienced a period of like very rapid weight gain in my life, which was my freshman year of college. And I went to college away. I was 17 years old. It was a very big university, Ohio State University. And I gained 80 pounds in 1 year, which is absolutely insane. I was barely eating anything that year because I was in an honors engineering program and it was very hard. So I rarely ate. I walked everywhere. Our campus was extremely large, lots of exercising, and I still put on that weight and pretty much found out from my doctors. They just said, oh, they assumed I was lying to them about what I was eating. They assumed I was lying to them about the amount of exercise that I was doing. And yeah, so there was like symptoms there. I just didn't know that they were PCOS symptoms.
Yeah. But even with this, with that kind of rapid weight gain, even if you were eating McDonald's three times a day and like not moving, it is near impossible to put on that amount of weight just from from calories, right? And this is where I rage so much when I see especially male PTs on Instagram being like, weight gain is just a cal, or weight is just a calorie equation. And I'm like, okay, you tell me how a 17-year-old can put on 8 pounds, 40 kilograms in 1 year with calories, right? You have to eat 3,000 calories more to gain 1 pound of body fat, mm-hmm. right? That is an extreme amount of food. Just the volume of that food, sheer volume of it, would have been almost impossible. I would say definitely impossible.
I was only 150 pounds. So that's like half my body weight, in 1 year, when you think about it that way.
Yeah,
you know, a 30% gain. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is why that kind of the weight is just due to a calorie equation is such a disservice to so many of us females. I'm calling your BS on that because I can show you that's not the case. But instead, because they don't have an answer for it, they just go, oh, you must be lying. And that's correct. That is. And the really bad thing is that this is what we got taught at university when I was studying nutrition as well, is that if a client is eating what you said you were eating and exercising and they're actually gaining weight, then they must be underreporting was the term mm-hmm. we got taught to use, which is basically, you're lying to me, you're eating more than what you're saying. And this is still what they are being trained to look for and see, and same with medical personnel as well. And so it's, I don't actually know what could be causing this, so I'm just going to say that you're lying. And that is, yeah, it is the worst possible scenario for many of us, that there's no further investigation being done. It's just, you need to just go and actually eat what you're saying you're eating and exercise like you're saying that you're exercising.
And it just makes you feel like a failure. Maybe it is just me, right? Definitely went through a lot of years of guilt thinking I was just doing something wrong, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that maybe you are missing a trick, like maybe all of your other, like your other colleagues at university weren't just walking around everywhere. They were also getting up in the middle of the night and doing this intense workout and you were missing the boat. Like, I remember thinking like that. I remember thinking I must be missing some trick. Like everyone else was doing this thing that I wasn't. And it's, hey guys, let me in on the secret.
Maybe they're eating more whole wheat wraps, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so for you, were there any other, so the hair growth and the weight gain, anything else like looking back on it that you're like?
Yeah, one other thing, which even persisted through up until I joined the protocol, was I woke up, no matter how many hours I slept, I would wake up extremely exhausted every single morning, and definitely a big coffee drinker for that reason, just to cope with it. But I was just tired every day. And so by the end of the day, I'm like, how am I even going to work out when I am just this exhausted every day? And I'd be getting a decent amount of sleep too. But then at the same time, I'd have a hard time falling asleep as well, which now I also know is another symptom of PCOS.
Yeah, totally. And so when you found out that you had PCOS was when you were going through fertility troubles. And so what were them? So you'd been trying for 6 months by the time you went to see the first And then when you finally got diagnosed with PCOS, what were the things, treatments that they offered you or advice that they gave you for that?
I actually was very lucky because I've read a lot of stories about OBGYNs who have no idea how to deal with PCOS. And their first thing to do is give you metformin, right? And then they send you on your way. I was very lucky because I have a very young doctor who's very progressive. She's done a lot of research. And she was like, myo-inositol. She's like, you should take this. I've done research on it. It's a supplement. It's not a medication. And I've had really great success with women on PCOS with this. So I got on that and the dechiro-inositol just from her, which was awesome. Mm-hmm. And then they did have an on-staff nutritionist that was an option as well, if you wanted to go that route, but they were not specialized in PCOS.
Cool. And so for you then, were you getting your period at this stage? Because many women that are trying to get pregnant, that's difficult for them to even get a period. Were you?
Yeah, so I was, and it was extremely regular, like 28 days, like clockwork every single month. So I'm like, I'm getting a period, right? So I must be ovulating and everything.
Yeah, absolutely. But no one did at any point, anyone sit you down and try and figure out if you are getting a period, because especially if they're suggesting, a lot of the suggestions for women with PCOS is to go on the fertility treatment drugs like Clomiphene or Clomid or Letrozole. But very little investigation is done. If women like you, if you are actually getting a period, it's like, is it actually going to work? Because if you're already ovulating, those drugs are supposed to make you ovulate. So if you're actually ovulating, there isn't really any additional improvement in ovulation rate and success rate.
Right. Yeah. So my doctor, she was under the impression that, oh, maybe you're ovulating, but it's not a good enough option, which I don't know if that's the right term for that. And she did say, oh, we'll give it 3 months on myo-inositol. And if nothing happens after that point, then we'll put you on letrozole, was her suggestion. She did tell me though, because I was tracking up until that point with like a P-test for your ovulation. She did tell me that was not effective for PCOS women.
Amazing.
Which is great. Yes, she
is incredible.
Honest to goodness, it was the best decision of my life, finding a new OBGYN that knew at least something. Then I started doing some of the basal body temperature, but I didn't really get the tools that I needed to like really properly track that yet. But she did tell me that was a better option.
Yeah, nice. And that's really good, because I had a patient tell me recently last week that she'd been to a doctor and showed them her basal body temperature charts of when she was ovulating. And it was in a question about whether she should be taking some micronized progesterone for her luteal phase. And her doctor turned around and said, basal body temperature is old, you know, old school. That's not even, you should be doing the ovulation predictor kit test, the P-sticks. And I was like, oh no, you have no idea. Right. So for anyone that is listening that doesn't know what we're talking about here, the ovulation predictor kits, the little P-sticks. And if you've been in any PCOS Facebook group, you will know these because you will see women posting them generally with two lines and their engagement ring around them. I don't know why this is a thing. It's apparently a thing. But anyway, they'll be like, can you see a line? Am I ovulating? And the amount of times that I'm just like, these are not accurate. Please do not use them. Please do not waste your money.
I do the same thing now. I'm like, don't use these.
These are not accurate. But the problem is, because other women see them in groups, they then think, oh, this is the thing to do. And also too, because they do work for women without PCOS, many friends would be using them and saying to their friends, oh, if you're trying to get pregnant, you need to use the ovulation predictor kits, right? So the reason that they are not accurate for PCOS is because they measure a hormone called luteinizing hormone. And in the majority of cases, in women with PCOS, your luteinizing hormone is too high. And so it'll be either showing you positives or it will just be showing negative all the time, even when you are ovulating. And if you read the fine print in the ovulation predictor kits or on their website, you'll see them state clearly that they are not intended for women with PCOS. So they even say it in the packet, right? So if your doctor's saying, no, you need to use these, or someone else is saying you need to use them, you just be like, actually, you should read the information. They are not for women with PCOS. So
my doctor told me that exact thing. She was like, it's in the packet.
Oh my God, she's amazing. Can we clone her?
I know, right? Give her to everybody.
Then what did you find out about your cycle when you did actually learn?
Oh yeah.
Were you ovulating?
Yes. So I was ovulating. I was just ovulating very late. So when my husband and I were like trying for those 6 months going up, and I actually compared it after the fact, we were trying around the time when those apps tell you're usually ovulating, which is usually day 14. Mm. And then once I had found out I was ovulating, because she actually sent me for blood work to confirm I was, it was actually not until like day between 19 and like 21 of like a 28-day cycle, which is very late for anyone who has been tracking their cycles of ovulation. Yeah,
absolutely. And so what that means is that A, you are completely mistiming, you're missing that window. And then B, you didn't have enough time once you're, even if you did time around the day 19, 20, when that little sperm and egg embryo didn't have enough time to travel down your fallopian tubes and burrow into your uterine lining to create a pregnancy before you then got a period. And so that's called a short luteal phase or luteal phase defect. And that's, again, super, super common in many women, not just women with PCOS, but many women. And again, another reason why you might not be getting pregnant, even if you're getting a regular cycle. And so this is actually really interesting. We did a podcast a while back with a woman called Dr. Stephanie. The podcast episode was called "Sciencing the Shit Out of PCOS," and that was her quote, and I loved it. And that was her only thing that helped her get diagnosed with PCOS, because she didn't have any, I think she either didn't have cysts or didn't have any other like irregular hair growth or acne or anything like that. And her periods looked regular, like yours. They were every 28 days. So your doctor would look at that and say, when did you get your last period? How often you're like getting your period? And you'd say, well, 28 to 30 days. And they might say, then you have a regular cycle.
Normal periods.
Mm-hmm. You do. But if you have a short luteal phase, you do not have a regular cycle, right? And that's why it can take some digging to find this out, or only if someone's actually going to look at it and help you track your cycle to actually identify this. So then,
that's super interesting.
Yeah. So then did your, so your luteal phase, how long did that take to actually get longer?
Yeah. So I started the protocol, and I had an interesting case of starting the protocol 1 week after I was diagnosed with PCOS, because I, again, like I said, I don't sit around and not do anything. I was like, I'm going to do something, and this is what I'm going to do. So I started the protocol, and it took me about, within about 2 months, my cycle actually started getting a little bit shorter. It started going down to like 26 to 27 days. But when I was tracking my basal body temperature, I found that I was ovulating around day like 12, 13. I ended up getting a longer luteal phase, just a shorter cycle.
Yeah. Well, and the good thing is that because you're measuring your basal body temperature to see when you're ovulating, you could see that you're like, oh, I'm actually just ovulating earlier. Whereas if you weren't, then you'd be like freaking out because you're like, oh my God, my cycle's getting shorter. And in many cases, that's a good thing. If your cycle's like 45 days, getting a shorter cycle is good. But if it's already at around about 28, 30 days, getting closer to 23 days isn't necessarily a good thing. Yeah, but because you could see actually just my ovulation has come back by a whole week. And the reason it does that is because previously your cycle, you would have been, your body would have been trying to ovulate about twice in that cycle, right? It would have been trying to ovulate around day 14, not able to. So it tries again, finally is able to around about day 21. Okay. So what, when you went through the protocol, what was it that you found was causing all these symptoms, like the rapid weight gain and the, especially the fatigue, the waking up really tired in the morning, the, yeah, all of that stuff?
I found out during the protocol that I was type 2, which means that it's both insulin resistance and stress, which I'm a high stress person. And that's actually another symptom I had, anxiety, which I found out is very common with people with that type. So it was the combination of those two things, my stress hormones and then the insulin resistance as well.
And that, did that start to explain to you why doing lots of high intensity workout with your PT and things weren't really helping?
So I had a physical trainer for a year and we did a lot of high intensity workouts, and I didn't lose any weight or inches that entire year, even with the whole diet and everything. And come to find out, when you have high stress hormones with PCOS, high intensity workouts actually make you retain the weight instead of lose it. And I found out that actually low intensity and then some moderate was a lot better for my own body than what I had assumed my entire life.
Yeah. So what did you switch to? What have you found that's really helpful for you?
Oh, I am very busy because I'm in grad school too.
What are you doing? So, what are you doing your master's again in?
Master's in financial crime and compliance management.
Wow.
So yeah, like anti-money laundering.
Yeah, I love it.
So I was very busy and I'm working full time. So what I found worked best for me was on my lunches and then shortly after work, I was typically walking, which because I started all of this during the very beginning of COVID, I was housebound, especially in New York, as I'm sure most of you guys saw on the news. New York was a hot spot for COVID. I started walking. I went from 2,000 steps a day to over 10,000 steps a day, which ended up being about 4.5 to 5 miles a day within a matter of a month or a month and a half. And I just increased every single day. And so I'd walk during lunch and after work. And then usually 2 to 3 days a week, I would do either yoga or some like white light weight training. And that's it. Like literally that's amazing.
Amazing. And how did your waking up and the tiredness and stuff go? Did that improve?
So that improved literally right from the start. Because obviously the first thing in the protocol you start with, because originally I thought I was type one, was the breakfast. So I changed my breakfast to high protein breakfast. Before, not gonna lie, I was a bagel and coffee kind of girl in the morning, as many New Yorkers are. And
I remember we had big discussions about this at the start, right? You were like, oh my God.
It was the complete wrong thing for me to be eating for breakfast. I switched my breakfast and I literally saw within the first 5 days of changing my breakfast that I was waking up so alert and with so much energy that I had no issue doing these long walks every day.
Yeah.
Because I was just energized and I was like ready to go clean the whole house. So that changed pretty fast for me.
And then what was the other things that you noticed or now make sense that you're like, oh, I can see why, based on knowing that my insulin was high and my stress hormones were high, I now know that there was that big connection.
So I started scaling back like my coffee, and now I only do, I do one shot a day still, but I was like a triple shot a day kind of person. So that is a huge reduction for me. And I cut that back and I found, I changed obviously what I was working out and what I was eating. And then I found that I was falling asleep way easier and I wasn't waking up in the middle of the night and I was sleeping better. And all of these things changed just because my stress hormones, the caffeine and the food, were setting those off. So it was just a ripple effect.
Yeah. And these are things that you just put down to life, right? You're like, oh, it's just, this is just how you feel when you're in your later 20s, when you wake up in the morning, and this is just how life is. And it's not until you make those changes that you're like, ah, no, this is not how everybody feels when they wake up. It shouldn't be how everyone feels when they wake up.
And not everybody takes an hour to fall asleep every night. Right? My husband falls asleep in 5 minutes and I'm like over here just awake.
Yeah. Absolutely. How did your anxiety play into this? Did you notice any change in that?
Yeah, I absolutely did. So obviously being in grad school and work at the same time, it's very stressful. So I had a lot of anxiety, occasionally panic attacks, especially during college. And I found that I hate to say it, but they pretty much disappeared. I would have like very mild anxiety about a few small things when like a big project or big test was coming up. But overall, the panic attacks went away. I didn't have the periods of crying from the stress. It was much different and much less severe. And I didn't have to take medication for it, which I was very thankful for.
Yeah, amazing. And I think that's a good thing when you said, I hate to say it, because I think it would be wrong for everyone to assume that, well, this is, they just need to do this and their anxiety will disappear, right? Because anxiety can manifest in different ways and different people and different things can help them. But one thing I think a lot of people don't realize is that caffeine can make some people feel very anxious. There is actually genetically about 17% of people in the world that caffeine does not make you feel more alert. Caffeine makes you feel anxious. And when you're waking up and fueling your day with caffeine, because you were waking up tired because of the knock-on effect of your stress hormones being high and your insulin being high, then that's what you turn to. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it is the right thing for you. Or it might not be the case for you, but it might be that when you're blood sugar was all over the show, what we call the blood sugar roller coaster or the sugar coaster, up and down, you're far less able to tolerate small things that happen. The tolerance for just being landed with another project at work where you were like, oh my God, I've actually got an assignment to do tonight and I cannot, this is all just too much, is so much less reduced. I know that was the case for me anyway, not that I was an anxiety sufferer, but that I found my tolerance was so much less than what it is today.
Yeah, I definitely do not get as stressed out now when I'm given an extra project. I'm like, oh yeah, got it. No problem. Done. Before, when it would give me like literal like stomach aches just from one extra thing on my plate.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just, I think that's it. It's resilience. And when our body is not functioning optimally, our blood sugar is up and down and up and down and up and down, and our stress hormones are constantly high, is that our resilience to tolerate extra stress is almost nil, right? It's very small. So that's why I think, yeah, sorting these hormonal issues out is not just about, as you said, not just about getting pregnant, not just about losing weight, not just about improving how we feel in the morning. It's also about how we can, how resilient we are and how well we can operate. And this also comes down to a bit to immunity. I don't know if you, did you ever, I've never asked you this before, but did you ever find that you got sick quite often previously?
Yes. So I would definitely have like colds fairly regularly. And then I get the flu at least once a month, or I'm sorry, not once a month, once a year. Once a month would be a lot. So
I was worried for you here.
And so that's gone down now. I don't get sick anymore. I just don't know if it's from this or if it's from the fact that I have literally been quarantining for a year.
And that will be interesting for you to see. I know that for me, it definitely did improve my, and this one going, the reason I asked about that was going back to that resilience thing, is that not only are you mentally more resilient or just physically more resilient because your hormones are much more level, but also to your immune system is way more resilient, because when you have that super high stress hormone, one of cortisol's things that it does is it just, so high cortisol all the time means that it is impacting our immune system from being able to function properly. And as we are for this year, like immunity has never been so important to us.
Yeah, I can't wait to see once things start getting back to normal, if it stays that way and I'm not sick.
Yeah. So for you, the other thing we haven't obviously talked about as well is the fertility thing. So what happened there? Take us through.
Yeah, so very exciting. So I did the protocol. It was 3 months, June, July, and August. And I found out in September that we were pregnant, which is crazy because we were actually supposed to start fertility treatments in October if we had not gotten pregnant yet. So I had made a deal with my doctor. I said, give me 3 months of trying this out before we start doing anything else. I don't want to go to a fertility specialist yet. I just want to see if we can do this naturally before I have to start doing IUI or IVF. Yeah, so we found out in September we were expecting, which is crazy, after nearly a year of trying to conceive. And now I am 36 weeks pregnant, very pregnant. I'm ready for him to come, which is crazy.
It's so amazing. And Sacha, you've had interesting things happen throughout the pregnancy as well, right? Like the first thing that we do when you get pregnant is I'm always like, get a progesterone, do this from the protocol. Like everyone's, I'm like, I'm going to send you, we're going to email you this information. You need to get a progesterone test done, and relatively often. And I also outline in my book, Getting Pregnant with PCOS, why this is the case. And so you got that done and you found out that your progesterone was a bit low, wasn't it?
It was slightly low. So it wasn't like very low, but it was like right around the cutoff for what my doctor said was acceptable, which was slightly below what you said the cutoff was for acceptable, right? So she was great. And she put me on the maximum dose for the vaginal suppositories, which she said were much more effective. And so I started that at 5 weeks, like literally right away when we found out. And then I continued that until week 12 to 13. And it kept my progesterone levels up the entire time, which is awesome. Because I was obviously high risk for miscarriage.
Yes. And that is, for anyone that doesn't know, that is the risk when your progesterone is low, is that it is potentially a greater risk of miscarriage. Now, if you say this, your doctor might say, that's not true. We know that progesterone does not reduce the risk of miscarriage. That's not true. That it is true for the general population. If you went and gave every single woman that got pregnant progesterone, there would be no less miscarriages than on average than not. But in people that have PCOS, people that have a history of infertility, which if you have PCOS, that is actually the case. Even if you haven't, you should be tagged in that. Or if you've had a history of recurrent miscarriages, then they found that testing progesterone, and if it's below, and the levels are in my book, Getting Pregnant with PCOS, but if it's, I say that 25 is the number that we're looking for, your doctor, I think, was saying around about 15 or...
15, yeah, and I was at 14.5.
Yeah.
So much less than yours.
Yeah. But, and that's the reason I say 25 is not because I have somehow come up with this number. That's based on what the research papers have shown is the optimal level. And if below that, we may be at risk of, and women that have low progesterone, yes, the research does show that progesterone vaginal suppositories, which is what you were given, do help reduce the risk of miscarriage. And if you're working with a doctor and they say, no, progesterone doesn't help, find a second opinion, because, and all those studies are in my book as well. So you can go to the research, you can like print off the article if you need to, but it is, it's relative. Like it, I wouldn't say it's just not well known. Like a lot of doctors and OBGYNs have just been told that, no, we've tested progesterone across the entire population and it doesn't help. But the nuance of that is a really important thing for people with PCOS. So that was brilliant. So you got that sorted. And my gosh, as we said, we need to clone that OBGYN.
My doctor. Yes. And then, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, and then another thing, obviously, that everyone has to go through is the gestational diabetes test.
Yeah. So I had to do it twice, obviously. So the first time, because she said with women with PCOS, you're obviously at a higher risk of having gestational diabetes. So they'd rather know earlier on. So I did it at 24 weeks, I believe. And then I had to do it again at the normal, like 32 weeks or so.
Yeah.
So I did it at 24 weeks and my level not only passed, but she said that they were like above and beyond great. So I was very excited. I did retake the test, obviously, at 32 weeks again for the normal one. And again, had the same results, which was phenomenal. So no risk there.
Yeah. And that's incredible when you already knew that your blood sugar and insulin was high only literally 4 or 5 months ago.
Right.
By that stage. Right. So it's amazing. So the reason why we want to get this tested in pregnancy as well is because pregnancy makes us more insulin resistant. That's part of the role of insulin is to get more like energy to the baby. And the way it does this is by increasing your insulin. So if you already have high insulin going into pregnancy, it's likely that might push you over into gestational diabetes. But, and that's why I always say with people with PCOS, I love it if we can, if you're going through fertility treatment, at least work alongside us in the protocol to help to bring your insulin down, if that is high for you at the same time, so that when you do get pregnant, you are going to be at much, much better insulin for your gestational diabetes, or improving the risk of not developing gestational diabetes. So that's so amazing. And I love it that it wasn't even, yours was what, like in the low 80s?
81 for the first time and 80 the second time. And I just had to be, I think, underly or something like that. It wasn't even close. And my biggest thing when I was, because when I was on all my walks, I would listen to your podcast. And the biggest thing that actually helped me, because I was struggling with the infertility very hard, and you can't really talk to other people about it. It's hard to talk to other people about it. Mm-hmm. The biggest thing you said was that you don't want to just get pregnant. You want to have a healthy pregnancy. And so I was like, you know what? It's not the right time for me to be pregnant right now. I need to be healthy so that I have a healthy pregnancy. Because I've had friends that have gone through gestational diabetes and preeclampsia and many other issues. And I did not want that for myself.
And it's also too, like, knowing that you're still, even when you do get pregnant, you've still got your, you're still going to be a grad student. You're still going to be working full time.
Yes.
And so do I have time to be, if I'm already this fatigued going into pregnancy, it's not going to get better.
No, it does not.
And that's my worry, is that if we have women who are so fatigued, waking up feeling like they've been hit by a bus, and you go in and add a 2-week-old infant into that who is crying, who you can't, especially first baby, you don't know why they're crying. Is it, are they hot? Are they cold? Are they hungry? Do they need a clean nappy? It's just a recipe for me for postnatal depression.
Yeah.
And we already know that in pretty much every country in Western country in the world, we have such poor postpartum care. In New Zealand, it's, at the moment, it's a really big hot topic. And it's that, what are we doing? Are we setting women up for failure by not really addressing this in fertility treatment? That it's all about just get you pregnant rather than, okay, let's look at this woman and this couple holistically and go, is there something else we can do while we're also improving, actually helping them to get pregnant, to make sure that they are going to have a healthy pregnancy and also have a healthy baby that's going to grow into a healthy adult? And that's, yeah, that's like what I'm so passionate about, is achieving all of that, because we can, right? It doesn't have to be binary. You don't either have to have just get pregnant or be healthy. It works together.
Absolutely. And one other side note, just because if anyone's listening to this, because sometimes I think with fertility, they always think that it's just the woman with PCOS. My husband, you also recommended my husband get his sperm tested, and he did. And it turned out that he was regenerating every 3 days instead of every 2 days. So when you're timing intercourse every 2 days, not going to work because his levels were too low. So that was another part of it. So just know that it's not always just you because you have PCOS, right?
Absolutely.
There are two people in the partnership.
Yes, so true. And that's the thing is if you're working on improving your luteal phase and things, and well, they might as well be working on improving their sperm at the same time. You'd hate to go through 6 months all of you working on stuff and still not getting pregnant and then find out that actually their sperm is, and you could have both been working on the same things at the same time. It's just efficiency. You and I, efficient doing is what we're all about. So yeah, that's what I really recommend. And especially when your doctor might have cottoned on to the fact that you have PCOS and all the focus goes on you, but we really need to take a step back and go, okay, yeah, we've got that part, but let's look and make sure there's not anything else happening. So yeah, very good thought. Now, is anything else that you would like to share your wisdom with everybody?
Oh, for me, the biggest thing was not waiting. And I think that's been the biggest thing that I have never regretted going back, is that I am so happy I did not wait on anything. Finding a doctor that would listen to me and advocate for me, signing up for the protocol and not like being like, oh, I'll just try another diet. The amount of money I've spent on diets and on personal trainers, just for me taking the leap and now going back and saying, I am so confident in knowing what works for me, what food works for me, what exercise works for me, what sleep works for me. All of those pieces now I genuinely know for my own body instead of just the generic American what works for them. So that's probably my biggest thing.
And it also frees up your brain space to actually focus on what you're good at, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And if there's one thing I always say to women, it's don't just work with someone who knows what they're doing, right? Like the amount of time that I probably spent 10 years trying to work this out for myself. And a lot of this is because I thought that I shouldn't have to, because this was my area of expertise. I was a qualified registered nutritionist and exercise scientist, right? If I can't work it out, then who should? But you're an engineer and going into like anti-money laundering, right? Do what you do well, and then let other people who know more about that figure that out for you, instead of you having to spend all your free time Googling and looking in Facebook groups and trying to find what other women are doing and try that and jumping from diet to diet.
Absolutely. The amount of time alone that's spent on Pinterest looking up workout routines, high intensity workouts, right? I can avoid all of that and focus on things that I know are going to work and honestly are more important in my life, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's the thing, is like the mental space you must now have, as you said, of just that, like, now I know what works for me. I know what's important. I know what I need to eat. I know that sleep is super important to me. I know how to get good sleep, and I can just actually focus on that. And I don't have to be thinking about, oh, well, should I, like, maybe I just seen that thing, Seaspiracy. Should I like remove all fish out of my diet? Should I go vegan? There's no longer any of that thinking.
No. Exactly.
Brain space. So yeah, I think that's a really good thing to pass on. So thank you so much for joining me. It's been amazing to catch up and chat with you. And also thank you for sharing all of your wisdom and story with other women with PCOS. I know that it's so helpful, and I know that you found it helpful listening to other women. I know when we spoke earlier, you said hearing that someone else also gained like huge amount of weight during college, and that, and having your story validated by that made a difference to you. So thank you very much for sharing your story with other women. That will help them see that they're not alone and that there is things that they can do to improve their health as well.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to do that, because it definitely helped. And I hope that someone hears what I went through and, you know, knows that it's not just them, right? Many of us have been through it, and it gets better. Yeah. Definitely gets better.
You also don't have to, if your doctor's or someone's saying to you, no, you just have to try for a year and only then will we look further.
You do not have to say yes.
You know, you can look for a second opinion. You can go, I actually think there's something else going on here. So go and advocate for yourself. And if you're a doer, be a doer, because you know that's going to make you feel better.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And we will catch you again soon.
Thank you so much, Claire.
Now stand by for our disclaimer. The information contained in this podcast has been prepared for the purpose of providing information, including about the PCOS Nutritionist products and services, and is designed to support clients' overall wellness. It is not intended to provide medical advice or designed to rectify, treat, or cure any specific medical conditions or diseases. Nothing stated or shared in our podcast is intended to be and must not be taken to be medical advice. Please seek the advice of professionals as appropriate regarding the evaluation of any specific information, opinion, advice, or content contained in our podcast.